Okay, good afternoon, everybody. November 5th, this is Bio 241, and we're in the middle of the endocrinology chapter. And let's see, we talked about HREs last time, the dimerization of HREs with signaling molecules and how they can act as transcription factors, influencing transcription, which eventually is going to end up in, what, protein synthesis. One of the last things that we were looking at is how the GLUT4 transporter is inserted into the plasma membrane for uptake of glucose. And we saw that insulin receptor is a tyrosine kinase. So once insulin binds to the receptor, that activates a tyrosine kinase. And what does a kinase do again? Yeah, phosphorylate something. Yeah, it phosphorylates something. It could be an enzyme, some other protein. Activating or inactivating that enzyme or protein. And since it's a tyrosine kinase, where does that phosphate molecule end up? On what part of a protein? What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. And what's tyrosine? That is one kind of amino acid. So tyrosine in a certain part of that protein molecule is going to be phosphorylated. So specifically that tyrosine amino acid. And then through a cascade of events, these, what did we call these vesicles that contain transporters in them? Endosome. That's an endosome. These endosomes will be inserted into the membrane, thereby conferring the glucose transport processes to the plasma membrane, not just the endosome, because these are where the GLUT4 transporters are held in reserve, waiting for that insulin signal. All right, but there are two ways that these GLUT4 transporters can be inserted into the plasma membrane, especially in muscle cells. Oh, but before we go there, why do you need these GLUT4 transporters in the cell membrane? Yeah, to transport glucose from where to where? Yeah, from outside the cell to inside, or for instance, from the blood to inside the cell. And why is glucose important for the cell? What? ATP production, because that's one of the input molecules for glycolysis, which feeds the Krebs cycle and electron transport, et cetera, et cetera. All right, so I would like for you to get the big picture of this. All right, so when insulin is not available in your system, maybe we have damage to the pancreas that's not secreting insulin, or maybe this receptor is not built properly. That's a different kind of diabetes mellitus. Right, the GLUT4 transporters are not inserted into the cell membrane, and glucose can't get into the cell, so these cells are going to starve because they can't get glucose. And that glucose is going to stay in the blood, and somebody with diabetes mellitus typically has very high glucose concentrations in their blood because glucose can't go anywhere else. It's just stuck in the blood, even though the cells right on the other side of that plasma membrane are starving for glucose. Okay, so if it's diabetes type 1, we could administer insulin. If it's diabetes type 2, we don't really know how to handle the malfunction of this receptor right here. So we like to say diet and exercise, two things you don't like to hear very much, right? But why is exercise so important? Diet, because we don't want to overdose ourselves on glucose. It's already high in the blood. That will just exacerbate that condition. But why exercise? We don't have it on this slide. And it's really, really important, because what does exercise do? Okay. It uses glucose. Okay, that's what I hear. But how does glucose get inside the cell in order to be used? This is the miraculous thing about exercise. In muscle cells, when you start to exercise a muscle cell, even without an insulin signal, these endosomes are incorporated into the plasma membrane. So with exercise, the GLUT4 transporters are put into the cell membrane so that those muscle cells can take up glucose and use it for metabolism, even without an insulin signal. Or even if there is an insulin signal, but if the tyrosine kinase receptor is malfunctioning, these GLUT4 transporters still are put into the cell membrane of muscle cells. If you do what with a muscle cell? What do you have to do to that muscle cell? Yeah, you got to exercise it somehow. Okay, and when you start exercising and the GLUT4 transporters get put into the membrane, what happens to blood glucose? it decreases. It goes back down to normal. So that's a perfect activity for somebody with any kind of diabetes. All right? Because exercise acts like what? An insulin signal. Even though your body can't produce it if you're type 1, or if you have the, if you don't have the receptors working properly, type 2 diabetes. Okay, so that's very important to understand about exercise and what it can do, how it can help somebody with diabetes. Okay. All right, so let's move. Any questions on that before we move on? No? Okay. I can't remember, but did you talk about the difference between type 1 and type 2 in lab? Yeah, okay. So you kind of know what I'm talking about. Good. All right, the pituitary gland. You have to flash back to your anatomy class. Where is your pituitary gland? What part of your body? Pelvic cavity? Oh, it's your brain. Oh, yeah, it's coming back to me. All right, so the pituitary gland is underneath the hypothalamus, which is underneath the thalamus, right? That's part of your diencephalon. And the pituitary gland is very interesting sort of gland because it's made out of part nervous tissue and part endocrine tissue. So part of it is part of your brain, and the other part is part of glandular tissue. And where is it, in what bone is the pituitary gland situated? What cranial bone? I think I heard something over here that sounded like sphenoid bone. I don't know, sphenoid. All right, the sphenoid is that butterfly-shaped bone that goes from one side of your head to the other, and right in the center you have the sella turcica, and that's a depression in the sphenoid that houses the pituitary gland. So you have an anterior part, here's a posterior part, and this to me right here probably looks like the optic chiasm or something. That's where the optic nerves cross over, if you can remember back to anatomy class. Right here, that's what this little bulge is. So here is the hypothalamus, and so here's the anterior part, anterior pituitary. Here is the posterior pituitary. The posterior pituitary is neuronal tissue. It has axons from the hypothalamus. And the anterior pituitary is glandular tissue. And it's not, it is not receiving any axons from the hypothalamus, but nonetheless, the hypothalamus controls the release of hormones from both the anterior pituitary and the posterior pituitary through two different mechanisms. And this is what we call the pituitary stalk. What's another name for the pituitary stalk? Another name for the pituitary stalk, big long word, starts with an I. Infundibulum. Infundibulum is another name for it, and it's got different parts to it, but you just have to know infundibulum. And what do I call it euphemistically in class? I guess I haven't told you that. Maybe I won't tell you. I won't tell you what I call it. Huh? Oh, yeah, the pedunculito. Did I? Peduncle? A peduncle. What's a peduncle in the brain? It's a group of axons that form a bridge, a major bridge from one part of the brain to the other. And so, for instance, there are peduncles that go from the pons, and the pons send signals into the cerebellum for controlling motor function in your body. Right, there are peduncles there. There are also peduncles that carry information from the brainstem to the cerebrum, big major conduits of tracts. Those are called the cerebral peduncles. And this reminds me of a peduncle here because it's a bridge carrying tracts from the hypothalamus into the posterior pituitary. But it's what? It's a tiny peduncle. It's not very big. So you could call that a pedunculito, but nobody would know except me what you're talking about. Right, so, but that helps reinforce what a peduncle is. Yeah? Okay. All right, so here is the pituitary stalk. So, in terms of the anterior pituitary, we have certain cells. So this is a nucleus, or many nuclei in the hypothalamus, will be told by the central nervous system to release hormones that are going to cause the release of other hormones from the anterior pituitary gland. So we have axons that release what we call releasing factors or releasing hormones that get picked up by capillaries in the median eminence of the hypothalamus, which are then carried to the anterior pituitary. And in the anterior pituitary, we have a secondary capillary bed And what the heck happens in a capillary bed? What happens in a capillary? And probably you should know why. Exchange takes place, right? So why can exchange take place in a capillary, all right, but not this blood vessel right here? What's special about a capillary compared to an artery or a vein? It's very thin. It doesn't have a muscularis layer. It doesn't have a connective tissue layer. It just has an endothelium, which is extremely thin, and some capillaries are leaky too. You should probably know designation of capillaries by how leaky they are. Right, they're continuous, there's fenestrated, there's sinusoidal capillaries, just depending on how leaky they are. But exchange can take place in a capillary. So here we have sort of an atypical circulation. Here is capillary bed number one, connected by a vein to capillary bed number two, and then here is a vein that's going to take blood back toward the heart. So what kind of system do we call this with two capillary beds back to back? Yeah, there's usually just one capillary bed in between the heart, right, between an artery and a vein, but here we have two. This is what we call a portal circulation. Okay, and a portal circulation is just a special delivery system. It's a door-to-door delivery system that's taking hormones from the hypothalamus and delivering them directly to the anterior pituitary gland. And so that's really nice because the levels of hormones from the hypothalamus can be extremely small because they're directly given to the anterior pituitary via this hypophyseal pituitary portal vessel. That's what we call this, hypophyseal pituitary portal vessel. Okay, and then these releasing hormones cause the release of other hormones from the anterior pituitary. If the hypothalamus releasing hormones into the whole circulation, they'd be diluted out and probably would have no effect by the time they got to the anterior pituitary gland. So it's really nice that we have this portal system. Okay. All right, so we said we got two lobes. I'm not going to ask you to know the names of these different lobes, but you should be aware that the posterior lobe is made from neuronal tissue, part of the brain, and the anterior part is part glandular tissue. And whenever you see this adeno, well, hypothesis, what the heck does hypothesis mean? Hypothesis is just a fancy name for pituitary. Okay, it just is a fancy name for pituitary gland. And adeno, anytime you hear this word adeno, you should think of glandular tissue, right? Or like adenocarcinoma, that's a tumor that has originated from some kind of what? Muscle tissue, nervous tissue, glandular tissue, or what? Glandular tissue. Adeno means glandular tissue. All right, so the pituitary hangs below via the infundibulum right here. Okay. As opposed to the posterior pituitary. So here we have the posterior pituitary. Notice that there is no portal vessel between the hypothalamus and the posterior pituitary. But there are two nuclei in the hypothalamus, the paraventricular nucleus and the supraoptic nucleus right here. What's a nucleus again? What is a nucleus? Yeah, it's just a group of nerve cell bodies that are doing something in the central nervous system. So I don't mean nucleus of a cell, nucleus inside the central nervous system that is a block of cells that are performing some kind of function. Okay, and these send axons all the way down through the infundibulum, through the median eminence, through the infundibulum, into the posterior pituitary. And when an action potential reaches the axon terminus, it's going to release a signaling compound. Now, usually, what do we call a signaling molecule that's released from a neuron when an action potential reaches its axon terminus? What do we call that? That's what we call a neurotransmitter. And do you know any neurotransmitters between cells, like what? Acetylcholine, norepinephrine, dopamine, serotonin, okay? Well, this signaling molecule right here doesn't go across a synapse to stimulate another neuron. It is released and it is picked up by a capillary bed. And these signaling molecules are what we call ADH and oxytocin. These really are not neurotransmitters because they're not stimulating postsynaptic cell. They're being picked up by the blood and delivered everywhere in the circulatory system where they might elicit some effect in some target tissue. These are what we call hormones because they're secreted by a cell and picked up by the circulatory system. But it's a little bit more complicated because you could think of these as neurotransmitters, right? Could you think of these as neurotransmitters? Because they're being released by what? By a neuron. Okay, but then they also have characteristics of a hormone because they're picked up by the circulatory system. This posterior pituitary is a ductless gland. It doesn't have any ducts carrying ADH and oxytocin anywhere. It's using the circulatory system for distribution. So ADH and oxytocin are hormones on one hand, but they kind of look like neurotransmitters on the other hand. So probably the best way to talk about these is that ADH and oxytocin are what we call neurohormones. Neuro because they are secreted by neurons, and hormones because they're distributed all over the body by the blood. And the posterior pituitary is a ductless gland. It doesn't have a duct carrying ADH and oxytocin anywhere. All right, so what does ADH mean? What does that stand for? Antidiuretic hormone. So what is the effect of an antidiuretic on your body? What is it going to do? It's going to make you retain water. Right? So what does a diuretic do? Makes you lose water. Yeah, makes you pee. So an antidiuretic is going to make you retain water. It's going to produce very small amounts of very concentrated urine. Right? So that's antidiuretic hormone. And when people have problems with the pituitary gland, maybe antidiuretic hormone is not being produced. So what's going to happen to a person who is not secreting antidiuretic hormone normally? Maybe it's not being secreted at all. What are their symptoms going to be? Okay. So antidiuretic hormone makes you retain water, but if we take that signal away, you're going to lose a lot of water. Right? If you're losing a lot of water, what are you going to be doing? You're going to be going to the bathroom all the time. Then you're going to be dehydrated. Somebody said that. You're exactly right. All right, so what other condition are you aware of that puts you into that state of diaphoresis where you're going to the bathroom all the time? We just talked about it. Yeah, like diabetes what? Mellitus. Diabetes mellitus, right, is producing an osmotic effect in your body where you're putting a lot of glucose in urine that draws water out of your kidney, right? And so that puts you into diuresis as well. Or it could be due to a malfunction in the posterior pituitary. And that disease process we call diabetes as well. But it's a different kind of diabetes. It's not diabetes mellitus because that's a result of what? A sugar imbalance. This one is just due to a water imbalance because there's no ADH. Anybody know what that diabetes is called? Not diabetes mellitus, that's called diabetes insipidus. Diabetes insipidus. When there's a problem with the pituitary gland. So you know now like three different kinds of diabetes. Diabetes mellitus type 1, diabetes mellitus type 2, and diabetes insipidus. All right, so if somebody's losing a lot of water all the time because they're peeing way too much, what about their thirst center? It is being stimulated. So guess what they're doing all the time? If they're losing water so they don't die, they have to drink a lot of water all the time. Okay, so sometimes I have a student that's walking around with a gallon jug of water. Okay, and I always ask them, why are you carrying that gallon jug of water around? And sometimes they say, well, I just don't like to drink water out of the faucet. I go, okay, that's a rational reason to some extent, but, you know, we all drink water out of a bottle, usually not a big aquarium-sized bottle, but because when you see somebody drinking all the time water or eating ice cubes, you should be thinking, oh, what? Diabetes insipidus. Maybe there's a problem right there. And so, as a matter of fact, elementary school teachers are taught about this, and kids with this malady are caught very early on. Because what are they doing? I got to go to the bathroom. Teacher, I got to go to the bathroom. Right? So they don't carry a big gallon jug of water, but they have other kinds of behaviors that you can tell. All right, so that's a non-release of antidiuretic hormone from the posterior pituitary. That could be an indication of a pituitary tumor, for instance. All right, what about oxytocin? Another name for oxytocin is vasopressin. Vaso means blood vessel. Pressin means that it's going to cause that blood pressure to constrict. I mean, that blood vessel to constrict, that's going to increase blood pressure. All right, but vasopressin not only causes stimulation of smooth muscle in blood vessels, but smooth muscle in other parts of your body. Give me another smooth muscle someplace where oxytocin might have an effect. The uterus, that's smooth muscle, right, for parturition. So that's a hormone that skyrockets when it's time to deliver a baby. Okay, so these are the two hormones from the posterior pituitary. And these are synthesized in the cell bodies here in the hypothalamus, and then they are transported to the axon terminus where they're stored in synaptic vesicles until they're called to be released by an action potential down that tract. All right, so this is the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract instead of a portal system, because the portal system is what? A blood vessel that goes to the anterior pituitary. But don't forget, hypothalamo means hypothalamus, and hypophysis is the pituitary. And in anatomy, we always start with the origin, and the second part of the word is what? The destination, or origin, insertion. So that's how you can tell which way this tract is going. Oh, what's another name of a tract that you probably had to know? By knowing the name, you knew if it was a sensory tract or a motor tract. Like the spinothalamic tract, lateral spinothalamic tract, you had to know. So is that a motor tract or a sensory tract? Spinothalamic is from the spinal cord to, where's the thalamus? That's in your brain, so that's a sensory tract, right? Okay. All right, well, let's focus on some hormones of the anterior pituitary. There's a list of them. And it secretes six trophic hormones that maintain the size of some target tissues. So for instance, prolactin is released from the anterior pituitary. That will go to the glandular tissue of the breast, and that's going to promote proliferation and development of the glandular tissue of the breast. So when does that happen? During pregnancy, okay, because you're getting prepared for having a child, okay, prolactin. Growth hormone stimulates the growth of bones and muscles and even adipose tissue. That's released from the anterior pituitary. Thyroid stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary goes to the thyroid gland, which is necessary to maintain the function and the health of the thyroid gland, and stimulates the release of thyroxin as well. We looked at T3 and T4 a couple lectures ago. TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, will cause the release of thyroid stimulating hormone. And ACTH stands for adrenal corticotropic hormone. Where's the cortex of the adrenal gland? You can probably just tell me a color. What color is it? Well, okay, what's this color? Pink. And what's this color? Yellow. Okay, so adrenal corticotropic hormone, is it going to affect the pink or the yellow? The yellow, because that's the adrenal cortex. The adrenal medulla is the deep part. All right, and so that's going to maintain the adrenal cortex, and the adrenal gland secretes a number of glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. And then the anterior pituitary also secretes two hormones that we call gonadotropins. Both of these are gonadotropins. There's FSH and LH. They work on the primary reproductive organs in the male and female, namely the ovary and the testes. FSH stands for follicle stimulating hormone, and LH stands for luteinizing hormone. So these are both gonadotropins. Let me see what's on the next slide. Okay, so here is a nice little synopsis of what we talked about already. Okay. All right, so I think I want to draw a little something on the board. I'll keep that slide up there. So how about adrenal gland. Now let's do a thyroid gland. Thyroid gland. Kind of looks like a little butterfly. So what does a thyroid gland release? What hormones? Yeah. T3 and T4. Okay, so why is this an endocrine gland? Why is that an endocrine gland? Because it's secreting a product. What are the products? Chemical signals T3 and T4. Where is it secreting them to? Into a duct that takes it someplace, or where? Right into a capillary, right? Right into a capillary that's in the thyroid gland. And then that capillary, once it's in the blood, goes everywhere in your body. All right? So what causes the release of T3 and T4? Here you have, let's see if I can draw this. Sort of, I can draw it like this. So here is posterior pituitary, anterior pituitary. What's this? Go ahead, make my day. I'll make you say it. Yeah, pedunculito. Okay, there's a pedunculito. Here is the hypothalamus. Okay. All right, so from the anterior pituitary, there is a signaling compound that goes to the thyroid gland. And what do we call that compound? TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. Now, how does the anterior pituitary know to release TSH to stimulate the thyroid gland? Because what's the gland that's controlling the anterior pituitary? Or what is the organ that's controlling the anterior pituitary? It is the hypothalamus. How does the hypothalamus control the anterior pituitary? Because, I'll erase a little pedunculito right here, it releases a compound called thyroid stimulating hormone / releasing factor. RF into the what? The hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal tract or portal system, portal vessel. So TSHRF goes to the anterior pituitary, causes the release of TSH, which goes to the thyroid gland, telling it to release T3 and T4. So that's why we say the hypothalamus releases releasing factors or releasing hormones. TSHRH is actually the same thing as RF. Some people call it releasing factor, some people call it releasing hormones. Okay, let's try another example right here. How about this one? What's that? That looks like a testes to me. Is that what you guys said? I hope so. What hormone does the testes release? Testosterone, okay. Testosterone, all right. Testosterone is important for secondary male sex characteristics like coarse hair, deep voice, strong muscles, right? Intelligence. Okay, testosterone from the testes right here. What stimulates the release of testosterone? There's got to be a hormone from the anterior pituitary, all right? All right, so here is something from the anterior pituitary right over here, and that is going to be a gonadotropin. Now, gonadotropin, and it's going to be LH in particular. All right, so what tells the anterior pituitary to release gonadotropin? And it's anterior pituitary, so it's not a direct connection via tract, it's via the portal system. So it's got to be what? A releasing factor. So from the hypothalamus, it releases GN, which is what? That stands for gonadotropin - what? We call it RF. So GNRF goes to the anterior pituitary, causes the release of gonadotropin, which goes to the testes, which causes release of testosterone. Okay, let's do one more. I guess we're going to have to do The adrenal cortex. How do we stimulate the adrenal cortex? With what hormone? What is going to hear? This is adrenal corticotropic hormone. From where? Anterior pituitary. What causes the release of ACTH from the anterior pituitary? It's got to come from the hypothalamus, and it's called what? ACTH RF or RH, adrenal corticotropic releasing hormone. All right, so we just use that same nomenclature over and over again. I don't want to do it eight times. Three times is probably enough. Okay. So releasing hormones or releasing factors from the hypothalamus go through the portal system into the anterior pituitary, causing the release of that respective hormone from the anterior pituitary. Posterior pituitary doesn't need releasing factors. Why is that? Because axons from the hypothalamus directly go into the posterior pituitary to release ADH and oxytocin directly into the blood. Okay? So that's the normal scheme of things. Okay, so growth hormone promotes growth, protein synthesis, movement of amino acids into cells. That sounds a lot like insulin in that respect, but not in terms of glucose, but in terms of what? Amino acids. Thyroid stimulating hormone stimulates the thyroid to produce and secrete both T3 and T4. ACTH stimulates the adrenal cortex to secrete cortisol and aldosterone. Cortisol is a glucocorticoid, and aldosterone is a mineralocorticoid. So one of these is going to affect glucose metabolism, and the other is going to affect sodium and potassium in your body. We're going to see how that works in a little bit. Follicle-stimulating hormone stimulates growth of ovarian follicles and stimulates sperm production. LH causes ovulation in the female and secretion of testosterone in the male. Prolactin stimulates milk production by mammary glands. I've never heard of any action of prolactin in the male, but it might have some action, but I'm not sure what. So release of anterior pituitary hormones is controlled by what? Hypothalamic releasing hormones. And there can even be inhibiting releasing hormones or inhibiting releasing factors that use different levels of feedback to maintain the proper levels of stimulation of these various target tissues like the thyroid, adrenal cortex, or testes. Okay. I think I talked about all this already, so I'm going to skip over this slide. Okay, so let's talk about feedback control of these various hormones. All right, so this is just a normal kind of response loop that you've looked at before. And so you should be familiar with what a response loop, what does a response loop always start with? Stimulus, and it always ends with a response. And the stimulus and the response will affect each other if it adds. If the response adds to the stimulus, what kind of feedback is that? That's positive feedback. If the response subtracts from the stimulus, that is negative feedback. All right, so let's take a look at, don't forget you have an integration center that has a set point that has what the normal value should be. All right, so feedback control of the anterior pituitary involves two different kinds of feedback. There's short feedback. Okay, and there is also long feedback loops. All right, so the short feedback loop involves retrograde flow of blood and hormones from the anterior pituitary to the hypothalamus, inhibiting secretion of the releasing hormone. So for instance, here's the hypothalamus releasing GnRH. That's going to have a stimulatory effect on the anterior pituitary. That's going to cause the release of both FSH and LH, which is going to go to the respective gonad, either a testes or an ovary. That's going to then cause the secretion of either estrogen or testosterone from the ovary or the testes. All right, so that's going to be in the blood. So the short feedback loop goes from the blood, when levels of estrogen and androgens increase, right, the anterior pituitary can see high levels of these steroids, and even though it's getting a signal from the hypothalamus to secrete, right, this still feeds back in a negative fashion, so that proper levels of estrogen and androgens like testosterone are maintained within a physiologic range. So this is what we call a short feedback loop. Okay, it feeds back via the blood from the gonads back to the anterior pituitary, thus shutting off the release of gonadotropins from the anterior pituitary. But there is another negative feedback loop where these sex steroids, they're in the blood, not only feed back to the anterior pituitary, but they feed back to the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus can measure the concentrations of these hormones. All right, and if it's the proper level of hormone, then it's going to stop releasing gonadotropin releasing factor, which is going to what? Stop the secretion of additional hormones into the blood. But if the levels of estrogens and androgens are too low, right, then the hypothalamus says, well, the stimulus is less than what the set point is, we better signal the anterior pituitary, which will signal the gonads to secrete more estrogens to bring it to the proper level. Okay, so here you have two feedback loops. Okay, and during certain parts of the menstrual cycle in women, this negative feedback cycle actually turns into a positive feedback cycle. Okay, so what normally the kind of feedback that maintains homeostasis and a normal state in people is which kind of feedback, positive or negative? Negative feedback, because it brings you back to the set point. Okay, but we probably have looked at a couple of circumstances where positive feedback is very important in the normally functioning individual. And one of the things that relies on positive feedback is this surge in LH, which is what? A gonadotropin. And that happens when a follicle in the ovary has matured and is ready to expel an egg. So what happens is, okay, estrogens increase right at mid-cycle, and instead of causing negative feedback, that causes a positive feedback. So the hypothalamus secretes more GnRH. It goes to the anterior pituitary, which also has positive feedback at that particular time for LH, which causes the ovary to, for the follicle within the ovary, all right, so LH is going to increase, so the follicle in the ovary becomes more and more fragile, more and more prepared for ovulation. But as that level of LH rises, estrogens increase, which causes what? A further increase in GnRH, a further increase in LH. So there's this big, huge spike in LH, and usually something has to pop. Something has to break. Something drastically has to change when there's positive feedback. So what happens to stop this positive feedback cycle? Then that mature follicle releases the egg, okay, and that stops that positive feedback cycle, and now you have a free egg in the female reproductive tract as a result of this LH surge, this big spike in luteinizing hormone. Okay, the hypothalamus, since it's part of the brain, receives input from higher centers in the brain that can affect anterior pituitary secretion. Right, emotional states, psychological stress can affect circadian rhythms, menstrual cycles, and adrenal hormones as well, like cortisol and aldosterone. Okay, the posterior pituitary stores and releases two kinds of hormones. We said antidiuretic hormone, which promotes water conservation by the kidneys, so you retain fluids. Oxytocin stimulates contractions of smooth muscle, especially the uterus during parturition. But glandular tissue in the breast also contains smooth muscle. Right, so when an infant is nursing, this oxytocin is responsible for what we call the letdown reflex. So this is a reflex when the mother's nipple is stimulated. There are nerve fibers that go to the brain, go to the hypothalamus, which says, aha, the infant is nursing, The hypothalamus releases oxytocin, which goes into the blood. Oxytocin then goes to the smooth muscle of the glandular tissue of the breast, and that squirts milk out the ducts of the mammary glands, and the infant starts to feed on milk. So we call that the letdown reflex. That's due to oxytocin, but not prolactin. All right, so what's the difference between prolactin and oxytocin? Both involve the breast, but one is important for maturation of glandular tissue, and the other is for activation of the glandular tissue producing milk letdown. Which one is which? Which one is responsible for maturation of glandular tissue? Prolactin. And the one that stimulates smooth muscle for the milk letdown reflex is oxytocin. So which one has to operate first? Say during pregnancy and then after parturition. Prolactin has to work first. The breast has to develop, right? And after it does, after parturition, then as a result of stimulation of the breast, oxytocin is released, and that causes the letdown reflex. So two different hormones for two different purposes. Okay. Is there anything else I want to say about that? Probably not. Okay, so the supraoptic nucleus in the hypothalamus produces antidiuretic hormone. The paraventricular produces oxytocin. And these are both transported along the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract to the posterior pituitary, where they're released when an action potential reaches this axon terminus. And it's controlled by the hypothalamus. Of course, the hypothalamus is controlled by various other kinds of things happening inside the central nervous system, including the conscious centers in the cortex. All right, so that's it for the adrenal, the pituitary gland. So the pituitary gland is like the master endocrine control gland in your body. It's controlling a number of endocrine glands, and we're going to talk about some of the other ones besides, what was the one we just ended up talking about? Just the pituitary, okay. And the gonads. Okay, adrenal gland. So the adrenal gland, anatomically, is superior to the kidneys. And it consists of an outer layer we call the cortex, an inner layer we call the medulla. And we talked about the autonomic nervous system already in here. So the adrenal medulla is important because these chromaffin cells inside the medulla act as the postganglionic fiber in a sympathetic pathway. It releases norepinephrine and epinephrine into the circulation, and that produces sympathetic effects everywhere in the body. All right, the adrenal cortex is made up of, so here's the adrenal medulla. We see the zona glomerulosa, the most superficial layer, the fasciculata is the middle layer, and the reticularis is the inner layer right here. These all make up the adrenal cortex. And these are all going to be stimulated by ACTH, adrenal corticotropic hormone. Okay, so we talked about that. The cortex is controlled by ACTH and secretes cortisol, which inhibits glucose utilization and stimulates gluconeogenesis. What's gluconeogenesis? And what does that do to blood glucose levels? Gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis is doing what to glucose? Breaking it down or making more of it? Making more of it from where? From glycogen or from pyruvate? From pyruvate, right? Taking smaller molecules, putting them together to make glucose, all right? And then blood glucose increases as a result of release of cortisol. So what kind of stimulus increases cortisol production? I don't see anybody having a good feel for that, but stressful situations, right? Stress increases cortisol. And that does what? Increases blood glucose. So what does that look like? Does that exacerbate diabetes, or does that ameliorate diabetes? That exacerbates it, right? Because you have now more glucose being put into the blood. Right, so stress definitely has an effect on the diabetic. Aldosterone, this is the mineralocorticoid. So cortisol is what we call a glucocorticoid. Corticoid means coming from the adrenal cortex because it affects glucose metabolism. Aldosterone, on the other hand, is what we call a mineralocorticoid. It doesn't affect glucose, but it affects some minerals, namely sodium and potassium. So aldosterone goes to the kidneys to resorb sodium and to secrete potassium. All right, so to reabsorb sodium, as sodium is being reabsorbed, that's going to have an effect on your blood pressure. Right, so as we maintain sodium in our bodies, we retain fluid in our bodies. And I tell you what, think of a tire that you have on your bicycle or your car. And if your tire is flat, what do you need to do to the pressure inside that tire? Do you need to decrease it or increase the pressure? Increase the pressure, yeah. How do you increase the pressure of your tire? Do you put air in or take air out? Yeah, you put air in the tire, right? Same thing for your blood pressure. If you have fluid in your blood, it seems really simple, but if your blood is made up of mostly water, and if you put fluid in your blood, guess what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up, just like when you put air in your tire. If you take fluid out of your blood vessels, what happens to blood pressure? It goes down, right? So if you retain sodium, automatically you retain water and it stays in your blood vessels, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up or is maintained. That's one of the reasons why we have aldosterone, is to maintain blood pressure, not on a second-to-second notice, but over long-term, over a week-to-week or month-to-month kind of time scale. So that's a very important mechanism. We're going to talk about that soon. But anyway, if you ever see a question on a test that says, what is the effect of aldosterone? Look at the effect on sodium and potassium, and what can you tell me what the effect is? Just generally speaking, is the effect to secrete both, or what the effect is actually opposite on these two, right? It is to resorb sodium and to secrete potassium. It's the opposite effect. So if you're ever taking a test, you're always going to want to look for the answer that shows sodium and potassium being what? Oppositely affected. And that's going to be the correct answer. If you can't remember which way sodium goes, always just look for the opposite of those two ions right there. All right, so aldosterone helps maintain blood pressure by resorbing sodium from urine, or the precursor to urine. And the adrenal cortex also synthesizes and releases some androgens into the blood. All right, so even if you're female, you have some male sex hormones from the adrenal cortex. Okay, and that helps maintain aggressive behavior. Why does a female exhibit aggressive behavior typically? Okay, like protection of young, right? That's probably the most aggressive behavior anyone would ever experience in nature, right? Is female aggression, not male aggression, but in particular for protecting young. What else is important for male sex hormones in the female? Sex drive. Okay, so that's all important. That's due to androgens produced by the adrenal cortex, even in the female. Okay, so the zona glomerulosa produces the mineralocorticoids, namely what? Aldosterone. The zona fasciculata and reticularis, and in particular, fasciculata produces glucocorticoids like cortisol and corticosterone. And the reticularis produces androgens. And the what's a precursor molecule for all these things? If you have too much of it, it's considered deadly because it produces cardiovascular disease. But it's absolutely necessary in the right concentration, and that is what? Cholesterol, right? So cholesterol is a precursor to all of these, and I can't remember if this is an exam figure or not. Maybe part of it is. Is part of it an exam figure? All right, so, yeah? No? All right, so you don't have to know all these different steps, okay, but you should just see the pathway of cholesterol being converted into pregnenolone, into progesterone. Oh, have you run into progesterone before? What's that? That's another important female sex hormone, progesterone. Right, progesterone then can be converted into deoxycorticosterone, which can be converted into corticosterone, and then finally to the mineralocorticoid aldosterone. So these are all very similar interrelated kinds of molecules. Only difference is a few functional groups on the molecule. All right, in terms of glucocorticoids, well, here we see the production of corticosterone, so this should be the same process as what we have over here. Progesterone can be converted into different forms of progesterone, right, which then can be converted into deoxycortisol and finally cortisol. And then these different forms of hydroxypregnenolone and hydroxyprogesterone can be converted into male sex hormones, namely dehydroepiandrosterone, DHEA, androstenedione, and other kinds of androgens. All right, so these are the sex steroids from what, the adrenal cortex. Okay. Oh, I went backwards. Don't have to go backwards. Okay, the adrenal medulla, we said, releases epinephrine and norepinephrine, primarily epinephrine, and it lasts a much longer time than norepinephrine in our circulation. The adrenal medulla is innervated directly from preganglionic sympathetic fibers. These chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla are actually modified postganglionic cells. All right, so I'm using some terminology I'm not sure that I ever defined in this class. Can you guys remember what a preganglionic fiber is and a postganglionic fiber? Oh, we did autonomic nervous system. Okay, never mind. Okay. Okay, and so sympathetic nervous system produces the flight or fight response, which is what? Characterized by increased respiratory rate, increased heart rate, and cardiac output, because force of contraction is also stimulated. General vasoconstriction in many parts of your body that increases venous return. As veins constrict, that increases your blood pressure, that also forces more blood back to the heart. And when more blood goes back to the heart, when the heart pumps, guess what it pumps? If more blood goes back to the heart, when the heart contracts, it pumps more blood out. Right? So in order for the heart to pump blood out, blood has to get to it. And so with venoconstriction or vasoconstriction, more blood goes back to the heart, and so it is able to pump more blood out to parts of the body that vasodilate. So can you think of some parts of the body that don't vasoconstrict? There's general vasoconstriction, but not everywhere in the body with sympathetic tone, with an increase in sympathetic tone. What parts of the body don't vasoconstrict when you're scared to death? GI tract gets less blood, it vasoconstricts, but what parts of your body vasodilate to receive that extra blood? Your heart, because it's working faster. Okay, and also skeletal muscle. So vessels and skeletal muscles vasodilate so that your muscles can work more efficiently, and blood vessels in your digestive tract constrict because you're not concerned about digesting food in a stressful, immediately acute stressful situation. All right, epinephrine also promotes glycogenolysis and lipolysis. What's glycogenolysis? Breakdown of glycogen. I think I heard glucose, but it's breakdown of glycogen, and it produces what? It produces glucose. So what is the effect on blood glucose? What's the effect of epinephrine on blood glucose? It increases blood glucose, right? So here you see a lot of things that increase blood glucose, steroid hormones like corticosterone, epinephrine increases blood glucose, so these are all things that actually help, like, produce a diabetic state, right, an elevated blood glucose. And there's only one hormone that decreases blood glucose. We have a number of hormones that increase, only one that decreases blood glucose. What's the one that decreases blood glucose? Is actually glucagon increases blood glucose. Glucagon works just like epinephrine almost. Which one decreases blood glucose? And this is the hormone that's absent in a diabetic type 1, Insulin, right. So that's probably why there is a problem for some people with diabetes, because most systems in your body are geared to doing what? Putting glucose into the blood, not letting cells take it up, like what insulin does. Okay. Stress and the adrenal glands. Stress induces a nonspecific response called GAS, General Adaptation Syndrome. That's caused by ACTH and cortisol release. So the higher brain centers experience stress, whatever that might be. What could be a good example of stress? How about an anatomy practicum? All right, you guys don't have to take that anymore. Well, so that's good. Okay. Or maybe anatomy test. But physiology tests aren't too bad, are they? Okay, well, that might be a stressful situation. And, of course, your hypothalamus is aware of that. That's going to release, all right, on the board I wrote ACTHRF, but here it's just called corticotropin releasing hormone. That's the same thing, ACTHRF or ACTHRH or CRH. That's all the same thing. Okay, that goes to the anterior pituitary. And that stimulates the release of adrenal corticotropic hormone. Okay, that goes to the adrenal cortex, and that causes the adrenal cortex to release cortisol. Okay, and of course then that causes glycogenolysis. Okay, and again, there's a short feedback loop and a long feedback loop for controlling both of these. Okay. So chronic stress can induce high levels of cortisol that cause a number of negative effects in the body. Atrophy of the hippocampus. Oh, this is real important because the hippocampus, if I remember correctly, is involved in memory. Okay. But the hippocampus is also involved in something else, extremely important. And let me just see if it's on this slide. Oh, it's not on this slide. The hippocampus, what did you say?
Learning,
that's right, learning, especially how to deal with new and especially stressful situations in your life, right? Because the hippocampus helps control what we call neuroplasticity, how your brain changes its structure and interconnections when you're presented with new information. And when somebody has clinical depression, it's the hippocampus that actually atrophies, so that you're less able to deal with new stressful situations. That makes you feel bad, which increases stress, which makes you less capable of handling stressful situations. So it's really a nasty kind of positive feedback cycle, clinical depression. Right? So this atrophy of the hippocampus, we really like to prevent with what? Antidepressant therapy to do that. So we can cause reversal of that atrophy by using antidepressants, which will actually cause that hippocampus to grow back, which also kind of is a new kind of concept, because we used to think that in the central nervous system, once a neuron is damaged, it can't ever be replaced, like in the spinal cord. So once somebody has a spinal cord injury, they're paraplegic or quadriplegic for life. But we now know that in the brain, there are stem cells in the hippocampus that can regenerate cells that have lost their function or have died in the brain. Okay, but look what chronic stress does. It prevents that from happening. Okay, chronic stress also reduces the sensitivity of tissues to insulin. We call that insulin resistance. That's a form of diabetes that produces diabetes when insulin doesn't work. Inhibits vagus nerve activity, which messes up autonomic nervous system response. Suppresses growth hormone, thyroid hormone, and gonadotropin. So stress can have a lot of very strange effects on the body. Okay, the thyroid gland. Okay. Thyroid gland is located just below the larynx. So here is the larynx. That is the first part of the proximal part of your lower respiratory tract. And you could probably remember all the names of these different cartilages right here. And it secretes T3 and T4. T3 and T4 set the basal metabolic rate of all cells. That means the basic rate at which these cells expend energy or utilize energy in your body. And also T3 and T4 is also needed for growth and development during growth periods and development. So here is a thyroid gland. It consists of follicles. And a follicle is just a tiny, tiny little sac with a hole in the middle of it. Right? And they're microscopic. You can't see them with your naked eye. The outer layer contains follicular cells that synthesize T4. The interior is filled with a colloid. And a colloid is just a fluid that's holding onto various kinds of molecules, like T4. It's just a protein-rich fluid, but it's not cellular in nature. A colloid is not cellular in nature. It's more like I guess you could consider it a tincture. A tincture is just a suspension of something. So it doesn't mean that these compounds are really dissolved in solution, like sugar water, but it means more like a suspension where there are really small particles, but they're not quite dissolved in that fluid. All right, so here we have a follicle, and you can see it is microscopic. You can see individual cells right here. And in order to make T3 and T4, you need iodine. All right, so here we have iodide. This is an ion that's in the blood. It's taken up by the follicle. It's actively taken up into the follicle and secreted into the colloid, where it's oxidized into iodine. Two of these come together to form I2, and it's attached to tyrosines of something we call thyroglobulin. That's just a large storage molecule for T3 and T4. So here we see iodide taken up. Okay, it's converted into iodine, incorporated with a thyroglobulin, okay, and there it's stored on that thyroglobulin in the form of T3 and T4. When TSH from, where does TSH come from? Thyroid stimulating hormone. Oh, let's see if we can make a picture in our mind. Where does TSH come from? The anterior pituitary. And how does the anterior pituitary know when to release thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH? Because it sees TSHRH. And where does TSHRH come from? The hypothalamus. Okay, so, yeah. At least I'm getting it. I hope you're following that around a little bit. Okay. All right, so TSH stimulates hydrolysis of T3 and T4 from thyroglobulin, and then it is secreted from the follicle, and then it's in the blood, and it's transported everywhere in the blood. Okay. So what is the ion, or even you can consider it a mineral? What is the mineral that's necessary to make a competent thyroid hormone? And a competent thyroid hormone is going to be either T4 or T3. And you said iodine. That's right. Or iodide. You need to have, and you can't make iodide or iodine, which means what? If you can't make it, you have to have it in your diet somehow, right? It has to be in the food that you eat. And I don't know what a good source of dietary, yeah, because salt artificially is iodinated, at least in the United States it is, not everywhere in the world. So we get plenty of iodine here in the United States because there's salt in everything that we eat. Okay? Huh? Kelp. I think, yeah, kelp make it naturally. Okay? So maybe seafood and maybe sea animals like fish and things like that have a lot of iodine. Sea salt probably has some iodine, but it's probably not to the same level that regular table salt because it's fortified. But there is a natural level of iodine in sea salt that you won't find in like regular kinds of salt because marine systems require iodine, like coral reefs and things like that. Okay. Okay. Now, can we take a really short departure from the class? Where does that iodine come from? How did iodine get on our planet? It's an element, because right when the universe started, the only thing that was part of the universe was hydrogen. How did iodine get made? What is iodine? How many protons are in an iodine? Are you flashing back to your first? Do you see iodide up here anywhere? How many protons are in iodine? Who can see that? Yeah, there's 53. There's 53 protons in the nucleus of an iodine. And everything in our universe started with just one. How did the universe make iodine? The only way to make iodine, to stick that many protons in the nucleus, is in a supernova. That's when a star explodes. So everything that makes up our solar system, right, has been recycled many times through many supernovas. And how far apart in time are supernovas spaced out? I'm not sure. Billions of years, something like that. So the function of this hormone in our bodies is a result of what? Like billions of years of evolution, even cosmic evolution. I find that kind of interesting. I don't know if you do. But anyway, that's where iodine comes from. It had to blow up in a star at some point in time to be made. And then it found its way to our solar system, and then we use it to control metabolism and things like that. All right, so in the absence of sufficient dietary iodine, you can't make competent levels of T3 and T4. So let's look at the feedback of how that works. Okay. All right, so here's a thyroid gland. It's going to be listening for signals from the anterior pituitary, namely thyroid-stimulating hormone. And when it sees that signal, it's going to get busy and make T3 and T4. And it's going to secrete whatever it has into the blood. Well, maybe it has T3 and T4, but if it doesn't have iodine, okay, it's not going to perform a physiologic function in the body. So it's going to secrete a lot of compound, but that secretion is going to be low in T3 and T4. And therefore, there's going to be very little negative feedback applied to the anterior pituitary because it doesn't see a proper level of T3 and T4. It sees a way suppressed level of T3 and T4. Why is that? Because what's missing? Because iodine is missing from the body. So the anterior pituitary says, hey, thyroid gland, you better get busy and make a lot of T3 and T4 because it's real low. So the anterior pituitary releases a lot of thyroid stimulating hormone, which goes to the thyroid gland. And so the thyroid gland listens to that signal and says, oh yeah, we better get busy, make a lot of T3 and T4. Let's get bigger. So there's proliferation of the cells of the thyroid gland. The thyroid gland gets real big, and it starts to produce a lot of T3 and T4, but can it? Because it's still missing iodine. All right, so this feedback system works over and over and over again. You have way high levels of TSH. The thyroid gland gets to be huge under these conditions. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger, trying to make T3 and T4, but it can't, because there's no iodine. And when somebody has this large tumorous thyroid gland, because they don't have iodine in their diet, we call that a goiter. And sometimes you might see somebody walking around with this big sac in their neck over here. And that's due to the hypertrophied thyroid gland because they don't have iodine in their diet. So how's that treated? Real simple. Yeah, real simple with a little iodine. Okay. So we don't see that very much in the United States. You might see that from immigrants if they come from a place where they don't have iodine in their diet, but it can kind of quickly resolve. Okay. So low T3 and T4 don't provide negative feedback, and that stimulates thyroid stimulating levels. It goes way up. And because TSH is a trophic hormone, the thyroid gland grows, right? That TSH causes the thyroid gland to grow, but it still can't produce T3 and T4, so it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay, people with inadequate T3 and T4 are hypothyroid. They have low basal metabolic rate, have a tendency to be obese as a result, so they gain weight, they're lethargic, and they're cold intolerant because they can't use energy in their body. That produces myxedema, that produces a puffy face and hands and feet. And hypothyroidism during fetal development, right, can cause cretinism, which is severe mental retardation because T3 and T4 are necessary for the normal development of the brain and spinal cord. So that's a terrible time to be hypothyroid. Okay, hyperthyroidism. Sometimes that can be produced by an autoimmune disease, where antibodies act like thyroid stimulating hormone that stimulates the thyroid gland to grow and over-secrete. We call that hyperthyroidism. And it's characterized by exothalamus, weight loss, right? Because that increases BMR, that produces a high BMR. Heat intolerance, because your body is releasing all that energy as heat, and irritability of the person. Now, what the heck is exothalamus? So, abnormalities of the thyroid gland are pretty easy to diagnose externally just from surface anatomy. Like the goiter is hypothyroidism, exothalamus is hyperthyroidism, and exothalamus is a very prominent eye position. I don't know if I have a picture. There might be one in your book. Do you have a picture in your book? Okay, yeah, good. So exothalamus is, in a bilateral condition, two very prominent eyes. It's like poking out of your head, okay? And very characteristic. That doesn't mean that everybody that has prominent eyes has hyperthyroidism, but if it's super prominent, that could be one reason. That's just a systemic effect of high levels of T3 and T4. But if you have one prominent eye, if it's not bilateral, if it's unilateral, that can't be due to a systemic effect. What might you consider if somebody has just one prominent eye? Somebody said something. Tumor, I like that. Somebody said tumor. Yeah, they could have a tumor on their optic nerve or retina or something that's producing that abnormality, because usually tumor genesis is not bilateral. It's going to affect one gland or the other. Okay. You can look over this table for various kinds of symptoms with hyperthyroidism and hypothyroidism. Embedded in the thyroid gland is another gland. And so it's associated with the thyroid. We call these the parathyroid glands. So in the posterior thyroid, we have these four little nodules right here, totally different gland. And they're involved with calcium metabolism, regulating blood calcium levels. All right, so you got these four glands. They secrete parathyroid hormone, or PTH. And this is the most important hormone for control of blood calcium levels. Is it important for you to maintain proper levels of calcium in the blood? What are some reasons that you're aware of? Muscle contraction. What else? How about synaptic transmission? Is synaptic transmission important? Because calcium going into the axon terminus signals what? The release of neurotransmitter from the synaptic vesicles, right? So you lose a communication between cells without the proper level of calcium. Can't contract muscle without the proper levels of calcium. Okay? So release stimulated by decreased blood calcium. So the stimulus is going to be a decreasing blood calcium, all right? Causes bones to release calcium, so it's going to stimulate osteoclastic activity. Remember an osteoclast? It's going to cause the kidney to resorb calcium and the intestines to absorb calcium from your diet. So decreasing blood calcium stimulates the parathyroids to release PTH. PTH goes to the kidneys that resorbs calcium from the urine that goes back into the blood that increases blood calcium. Right, that also decreases urinary excretion of calcium because it's going back into the blood. PTH goes to bone. That causes, that activates osteoclasts, which break down bone, which dissolves the hydroxyapatite in bone, which is the calcium phosphate crystal that increases blood calcium. And then increasing blood calcium is, what do we call this in a response loop? Increasing blood calcium is what? Is the, in a response, that's the response of a response loop. And a response is going to feed back to the stimulus, right? And this is going to increase, right? So increase is opposite than decreasing. So the response is opposite compared to the stimulus. So this feedback loop is a nice negative feedback loop, maintaining the proper level of calcium in your blood, for instance. Okay, and if this proper level of feedback isn't maintained, maybe we put too much calcium in your blood. What happens to your bones if that's the case? If too much calcium is put in the blood, what happens to bones? They demineralize. What's that condition caused or called? That's osteoporosis, for instance. Okay. Okay, the islets of Langerhans. Oh, where are they at? They're in the pancreas. That's right. So the pancreas is an interesting kind of organ. The stomach would be about in this region right here. So the pancreas is inferior to the stomach and a little bit posterior to it as well. And the pancreas is kind of triangular shaped. The head of the pancreas is closest to the duodenum. The tail is way over lateral, and this is the body of the pancreas. The pancreas has both an exocrine function and an endocrine function. So what the heck is an exocrine gland? What does an exocrine gland do as opposed to endocrine? Exocrine gland produces a product that gets secreted into a duct, and that duct carries that product to where it should go. So the pancreas produces digestive enzymes, and where do those digestive enzymes belong? In the digestive tract. So how do they get from the pancreas to the digestive tract? Via a duct, because that's part of the exocrine function of the pancreas. So that's what this pancreatic duct is for. And here's a little accessory pancreatic duct. And then that empties the digestive enzymes into the duodenum. But that's really not what we're interested in today. We're interested in the endocrine function of the pancreas. So what is what's an endocrine gland again? Where does it secrete its product? Directly into the blood. Does not need a duct. And so there are some parts of the pancreas which we call the islet. So here's a little islet. So it looks like a little island right here, and it's filled with cells. And we have two different kinds of cells. There's alpha cells and beta cells. And these have glucose receptors in them. So it can monitor blood glucose. And so they're involved with controlling glucose metabolism. The alpha secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose. All right, so what do you think the effect of glucagon is going to be? Well, it says on this slide. All right, I thought maybe the next statement would be insulin, but it's not. Glucagon stimulates glycogenolysis and lipolysis. What does glycogenolysis do? It breaks down glycogen. Yeah, breaks down glycogen to produce glucose, which ends up in the blood. So that raises blood glucose. So what was the initial stimulus? The initial stimulus was low blood glucose. Glycogenolysis increases blood glucose. So here's another nice, what, positive feedback or negative feedback mechanism? Negative feedback mechanism. And lipolysis also produces energy for cells, right? It doesn't necessarily produce glucose in the blood, but it produces energy. All right, and that increases blood glucose levels. So glucagon increases blood glucose via glycogenolysis, or the breakdown of glycogen in the liver. Okay. And then next time, we're going to start with insulin. Remind me to start here. When do we start here? Wednesday, that's right, because Monday is a holiday. So please don't come to school. They won't let you in. The doors will be locked. Okay.